Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Affirmative action on college campuses ended today. The Supreme Court ruled in two separate cases saying race cannot be a consideration for college admissions. It is a landmark decision that will immediately impact the racial makeup of predominantly white institutions of higher learning, but it may not stop there. But joining me tonight to talk about this are Tanya Clay House, attorney and executive vice president of campaigns and advocacy for the Hip Hop Caucus. It's a grassroots organization focusing on issues impacting underserved and vulnerable communities. And civil rights attorney Donald Temple. Lines are open if you have a comment, if you have a question about today's historic ruling from the Supreme Court at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can also tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Tanya, Donald, thank you both for joining the conversation.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Tanya, I want to start with you. I want to get your reaction. Are you surprised or did you suspect that this was coming?
Unfortunately, I wasn't surprised, but I'm still outraged and angered. I mean, it was something that we saw coming, and truthfully, based upon what was happening earlier this week and based upon my decades long of watching the Supreme Court rulings, when you get some good rulings early on, you kind of see what's coming up on the end. And unfortunately, this is what I saw coming, but we also recognize it from the oral arguments. So, I saw it coming, but that doesn't lessen the outrage and disappointment and just outright, contempt that I have for how the Supreme Court completely has ignored decades of precedent.
This certainly is personal for you because these issues have come up in two of the schools you attended, the University of Texas and the University of Michigan.
That's correct. It is very personal. I was involved in working and organizing over the Greta V. Bollinger case because, as you indicated, I am a graduate of the University of Michigan. And so I was organizing on that. I am an affirmative action baby. I have no problem saying that. I recognize that the utility of affirmative action at the University of Michigan, and even when I was there, it was still less than 7%, I believe, of black students on the entire Michigan campus. At the University of Texas School of Law, once again, I was the class. We had approximately 30 or so in my entering class. We had just come off of the Hopwood v. Texas lawsuit that was working up through the Fifth Circuit. Again, our affirmative action program was challenged. I was protesting during law school about the issues that were impacting us there. The entering class the following year went from my entering class number of 30 to 4. So that tells you the impact of affirmative action in schools, both undergrad, law schools, and, every else in between.
Donald, make this plain for people who are still trying to figure out what happened today.
I mean, I will do my best, but I could just say that people have put on blinders to the history of race discrimination. I commend to folks' attention the Thurgood Marshall dissenting opinion in Allen Bakke, like Tanya, but at a different point in time, while I was in law school in California in 1977, we were protesting the DeFuentes and Bakke decisions. But Thurgood Marshall made it clear that the tide was changing, and the court made it clear in its opinion in that case, Justice Powell, that we're not going to talk about past discrimination in a traditional sense. And the debate moved and shifted from race to what we call diversity. And the diversity characterization of this problem continued for years, past this University of Michigan case, up to the present with variations of the theme. But now, at this point, we're at a place where the post-racial Obama era, the Trump reverse discrimination era, which is not beginning just now, it started well before 1977, theoretically, but more formally in the courts with the DeFuentes case versus University of California and the Alan Bakke case, the theory of race discrimination. So we're at a point now, and we saw it coming. I blame the court, no question about it, and the significance of how the court is appointed. But also, it's a wake-up call to us that this is no longer a fiction or figment of our imagination. The world as we have known it for the last, since Brown v. Board of Education, 1954 forward, has allowed race in some variation to be considered. That door closes, at least the predominantly white institutions, but not only there in education, but it will factor across the board. This is a cancer, and I think that Justice Jackson said it best. This is an ostrich-like decision. You want to say that we have a colorblind society, and yet our eyes, our society's eyes at every level are actually bloodshot with stains of racism.
So what, as I said, what happened today that we, that is no, that wasn't the case yesterday before this decision came down?
Race is out as a factor for admissions into college.
Well, what also happened is that we have a completely different Supreme Court makeup. Let's just be honest and very clear about what has occurred in the interim between Greta V. Bollinger and now, because at that point in time, Greta V. Bollinger, we were talking of, you know, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor indicated that she hoped that in 25 years that we may not have a need and to continue to have race as a factor in order to remedy the persistent and consistent discrimination that has occurred against black and brown and underrepresented people throughout this country. She hoped that, but she did not say that it was going to happen. We just hoped that. And unfortunately, during that time, those who have been itching and really, you know, trying to undermine the ability and the remedies that have been afforded after for Brown v. Board of Education, they have been utilizing that and misrepresenting that ruling in order to eliminate the use of race in college admissions, and I think broadly. So this is that step that has been taken, and it was only able to be taken because you did have the, you know, the ability, the makeup of the Supreme Court that changed, which was a result of having somebody in the White House who enabled that, which then was a result. That was a result because people, you know, you vote. You vote and determine exactly who's going to be there, and that person has a significant impact upon the courts.
Well, I think to put that succinctly, as we've been hearing for decades and decades, elections have consequences, and this is,
they do.
And certainly this is one of them. We are talking about the overturning of affirmative action in higher education by the Supreme Court today. Race is out of consideration when it comes to admissions for colleges and universities. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I do want to kind of read some of the comments made during the decision. today. And I'll start with Chief Justice Roberts, where he said, you know, both programs, talking about Harvard and the University of North Carolina, he said both programs lack sufficiently focused and measurable objectives warranting the use of race, unavoidably employ race in a negative, meaningful, unavoidably employing race in a negative manner involve racial stereotyping and lack meaningful endpoints. Now, that was in his majority opinion. He goes on to say, we have never permitted admissions programs to work in that way, and we will not do so today. But I think the thing that's probably most striking is the back and forth between the two black members of the Supreme Court to date, Clarence Thomas and Ketanji Brown Jackson. And, you know, where she said, and you know, you did mention this a bit earlier, Donald, in her comment, but what Thomas said was, while I am painfully aware of the social and economic ravages which have befallen my race and all who suffer discrimination, I hold out enduring hope that this country will live up to its principles so clearly enunciated in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, that all men are created equal, are equal citizens, and must be treated equally before the law. And of course, Ketanji Brown Jackson said in a broader dissent, because she recused herself from the Harvard decision because of her connection to Harvard. But in the broader discussion about this, she said that that the argument made by the chat.
Please hang up and try again if you need help.
We're gonna pick Tanya back up. But she said that the argument made by the challengers that affirmative action programs are unfair blinks both history and reality in ways too numerous to count. But the response is simple. Our country has never been colorblind. Obvious to those to those of us of color, Donald, but she said what she said.
But you know, you have to view Ketanji Brown. You can't, I mean, Justice Sotomayor's extensive dissenting opinion was really foundational in both opinions, and Ketanji Brown's support and embellishment upon that decision. And what Ketanji said in one word is everything. She said, a page of history is worth a volume of logic. And what we have here is really a parallel. I mean, and our readers should really look, and I say juxtapose Thurgood Marshall's dissenting opinion, which really parallels what Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson wrote. I mean, the movement away from past discrimination, particularly, and you would note that in these opinions, they're really talking substantially about black Americans.
Hold your point, because I've got to take a break. But we're going to come back and continue this conversation about this landmark decision. The U.S. Supreme Court, by a vote of 6-3, overturning affirmative action in higher education. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's going to be on WHUR. This conversation continues on SiriusXM Channel 141. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about the overturning of affirmative action in higher education by the Supreme Court. My guests are Tanya Clay House, attorney and executive vice president of campaigns and advocacy for the Hip Hop Caucus, and civil rights attorney Donald Temple. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Donald, finish your point.
Yeah, and I was speaking about the history. The fact of the matter is the writing's been on the wall. And Tanya spoke about the 2003 University of Michigan case, but we saw the Supreme Court coming in 2014, basically affirming a ruling in the the Michigan, state of Michigan, upholding the constitutional ban of an affirmative action. And I think now we are angry, we are upset, but we have to step back and ascertain where do we go from here. This is a reality. The stage is set now for in terms of where we go. This is the highest court of the country. And though we are frustrated and angered by the decision, we now have to rethink our thinking to ascertain where what its implications are and where do we as a community and as a nation move to ensure that we protect our interest.
Well, let's talk about that because earlier today, I had an opportunity to talk to Justin Hansford. He's a Howard University law professor. He's also the executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center. Now, I asked him about the impact that this could have on HBCUs. This is what he had to say.
I anticipate that HBCU applications will soar after this ruling. Now, I do not anticipate that overnight HBCU admissions will soar. We have capacity issues to deal with. So how HBCUs will be able to handle that capacity if they do decide to grow is something that we will have to watch closely in the coming weeks and months ahead.
All right. Again, that's Justin Hansford, Howard University a School of Law attorney. You know, this does, Tanya, have bigger implications, and not just on college campuses, but this could be the next step toward the elimination of affirmative action policies in C-suite boardrooms and other main street organizations and issues.
So what I want to say to that is this, that is an argument that the right wants us to believe, and that those that want to eliminate the use of race in all aspects of our society. And I want to push back some on the idea that there is no ability to use race in other contexts. In this ruling, yes, we have lost the ability to use race in the college admissions process. Now, individuals still have the ability and applications to explain and to talk about their experiences. And race is a central part of who it is and who people are. So that is something that was pulled out within the ruling. At the same time, I do want to say that in recognizing that we still have that opportunity, that this is a confined, this case is about these two colleges. This is about Harvard, this is about UNC and their admissions processes. What determines, you know, what happens with other colleges and universities is up to them. Many have already changed and, you know, have other patterns by which they're going to be, they admit. And so this is not going to impact them in the same way. But there is that message that you were just saying that others want to put out there that this is the end to all things and all the use of race. And I want to be cautious about saying that because we know that, and those, when I say we, I mean black people, I mean brown people, indigenous people, those of us who are about to be the majority in this country, we have the power to be able to push back and say that, no, that is not the case. And in fact, this was specific to this issue, and that there is more that we can still do in order to ensure that we are actually fulfilling the promises that are owed and that are due to all of us, because we are not living in a colorblind society. The solutions and the remedies for Brown v. Board cannot be race neutral, because the reason for Brown v. Board was not race neutral. It was race specific. It was specifically discrimination against children, against black children. And so therefore the remedy cannot be race neutral. You have to consider race. So there are, you know, there's different arguments I'm sure that many are going to be making, but I think we as a people have to recognize our power and our ability to push back and make sure that we are able to exercise and ensure that we have the equal opportunity in all aspects, not just within higher education, but in the class, but in the boardrooms, you know, in our professions, and in other aspects in this country.
Let me go to the phone lines and hear what our listeners have to say. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Teresa, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call, Harold. This is very disappointing, but this is going to hit business. This is going to hit, of course, the boardrooms. And also, this is the result of not voting. Young people, I've called several times, Harold, and I'm always telling the young people, you know, when they say they have to be inspired by a candidate, this is what happens when you do not vote. The ballot box is where we can voice our opinions. And so, and it's funny how that their decision does not affect the military. So if you look at what Justice Jackson said, it's about the, they can go to, affirmative action can remain in the military schools, but not the boardroom.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Yep. All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
Thank you so much. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Jim calling from Los Angeles. Jim, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Harold and guests. Basically, I have a comment.
Go ahead.
Each day or in this country, it's almost a stark reminder of what African Americans gave up to become, quote unquote, equal to whatever ambiguous thing a white person has. And basically, my point is, Brown versus Board of Education, although it was a great tool to equalize the field for African Americans against their counterparts, it seems that it is becoming nullified to the point where we're back at square one. However, we don't have that economic base where we had the support of our community. And I say that all to say that in education, in business, in healthcare, it is a constant reminder in America that says you're really not equal to a white person or an Asian person or what have you. And we'll still take your money, of course, because it's an economic booster, but we won't accept you as an equal member in this society that we call America.
Okay. Jim, thank you so much. So here's my question for you, Donald, and also Tanya, but Donald, I want to bring you in on this part of the conversation. So the decision has been made. So moving forward, and this is an oversimplification of this, if this ruling says that race is no longer considered for admissions, does that mean that the next black high school senior, a girl or boy, who decides that they want to go to Harvard or Stanford or Yale, does that mean that when they submit their application that they don't submit a photograph? Does that I'm serious. Does that mean that if your name is Daquan Thomas Johnson, that you need to submit your application as D. Thomas Johnson? Or I say that because there are still going to be indicators of race. It could be where you went to high school. It could be zip code. And you could be a straight A, you could be a straight A student with no community service. And so what does that mean for applicants?
I think that two things. One is that this decision is like Brown in the sense that it is now precedential. it's a precedent that's being set by the court, and it's like a stone being thrown into the pond. It's going to have ripple effects in terms of the manner in which it's interpreted by other universities, and in potentially and likely in an adverse way. But I don't think that it means that race is an adverse consideration, that because you're whatever your race is, black or non-white in particular, that you there's going to be an adverse reaction to that in that way. It could be in terms of the fallout. I think that the levels of accountability have to be formidable in terms of looking at the decision. The decision came out today. There's some language in the decision in terms of vehicles that universities can use, I think, potentially, as Tanya suggested, might preserve some relative use of race. But I think, and I think it's important, though, is as I mentioned earlier, in our community, fundamentally, we had to rethink things. Most of the reaction to this is public and political, the courts. As a young student here at Harvard in 1973, I heard John Johnson say in Quit the Auditorium that we as a race have to become indispensable. That means that we have to begin to develop the tools and the structure to make sure that we have value and that we have capacity. I disagree with the gentleman earlier. We have capacity. We have estimated 50 million black people. We have consumer-based income of $1.5 trillion. But our leadership has to begin to rethink. If we're spending money making people rich and those people have political influence, then we need to think about how we're spending our money. We need to rethink what we're doing in terms of our values. We did not. This is not something that we just learned today. This is something that we saw coming in 1977 and 2003, 2014. We knew with the election of Donald Trump what was on the drawing board. But our thinking has been too superficial in some sense. It's been light in terms of what's actually happening. This, to your listeners, is a major decision. Now we have to begin to think about how more collectively, more innovatively, more creatively, we harness our resources. We change the way that we think so that we're not just depending on the President of the United States or the Supreme Court in terms of advancing our interest. We have to begin to look within our own community as what we can do that's going to affect how they think, but also maximize our resources, maximize our ideas, maximize our imaginations. Black people don't exist in an isolation.
And I agree with that, and that is a wonderful theory. But if I'm trying to get into Harvard, Donald, in the fall or next year, my nephew, I've got a nephew, straight-A student, just because he is brilliant. His biggest problem right now, 1 year before he goes to college, is it going to be Vanderbilt? Is it going to be Harvard? Is it going to be Princeton? Or is it going to be Columbia? That's his problem right now. But as I said, and this is for you, Tanya, you said yourself you were an affirmative action baby. If this decision had happened when you were in 11th grade, do you believe that you would have been able to go to UT?
You know, I appreciate that question because I wanted to bring up this other issue. I say that I was an affirmative action baby. I was also an athlete.
Uh-huh.
And so let's just be clear. I recognize that there were multiple things that I had working that I could utilize in trying to attain a higher education. Both, you know, exercising my experiences, what I've been through as a black woman in this society, but also I had my academic qualifications were just as good as anybody. And I was an athlete. So who knows? But I have no problem saying that I'm an affirmative action baby because I recognize that had it not been for these affirmative action policies, that there are things and that these admissions, admissions counselors may not be looking at my qualifications the same way they may have been looking at others. And so one of the things that I wanted to say as we speak about this issue is, as the justices are so busy talking about how race cannot be considered as a factor, why is it that we are not also looking at legacies? Why are we not looking at all of those who are automatically considered to be admitted into these colleges and universities, but suddenly it's about race? Those of us who are black and brown are the ones somehow prohibiting others. Yet the legacies, those, they're not prohibiting others from getting into a college or university, even though they may not have the qualifications, the same ones that we have, that we deserve to be at these colleges and universities. So, you know, I'm going to be perfectly honest. I don't know exactly what it is that, you know, all the different things that they were, you know, they looked at, because I think it was a variety of things. I had multiple things that were working, you know, that were working with me and for me. But I'm just suggesting that there are a lot of things that we also need to look at, and that colleges and universities need to take into consideration, that are impacting the ability for them to maintain a diverse society, or a diverse academic environment. And one of those is continuing this legacy program.
Well, and legacy is one thing, and you make a valid point, but then, even if you didn't go, but if you decided to contribute and put your name on a building and you want your children to go, and your children, I don't want to go. No, you're going to go because I contributed.
I put that money on there.
Exactly. I contributed $20 million because I got it like that, because I like Harvard, or I like Stanford, or I like USC, or whatever. And so you're going to go, and even if your grades suck, you know, money talks.
I think that, Harold, with all due respect, you know, we can have very reactionary views to, I mean, you know, visceral views. Somebody wants to go to Harvard. It's mm-hmm. going to be different now.
But
it's going to be different. Race is not going to
be different.
Race has been a factor historically.
Yeah.
Today, after today, the Supreme Court says it's not, and it's very clear. So we need to face that reality and what it means, and how it is manifested in terms of the admissions to school, perhaps even as soon as next year.
Is this a stay ready, so you don't have to get ready situation for black people now?
Well, it's not just stay ready. It's stay ready. It's get ready. It's move. It's understand the reality. And as I said, we there's been a law. You know, we've always been on the assimilation side of things. We want to be like, act like, think like, and we're comfortable in that space. The reality, though, is that race, as bad as we know it is, as bad as it was articulated in this decision by both sides, quite frankly, the point of the matter is that the system doesn't treat race as a venom in this society. There's no sanctions when we have race in employment, when we have race in education, when we have race in policing. What I think is that there are avenues where, I mean, quite frankly, there needs to be much more egregious response to egregious racism. If you're going to say we're going to be colorblind and, like Judge Jackson said, be ostrich-like and put your head in the ground, then we got to get people to take their heads out of the ground at a time when there is white reactionaryism, CRT, for example, where people don't want to know the history. As I mentioned to you, what Ketanji Brown, Justice Jackson said. You know what I mean? So we have a problem. We as a people have a problem. We have to realize that. We have to begin to organize, to maximize resources, to collaborate, to bring institutions together, to figure out how we can do things that need to be done in our community. Individuals can't finance buildings. Groups have to look at that, whether it's supporting black schools, whether it's financing kids for other programs, whether it's better preparing them. We have to tighten up our game.
Mm-hmm. So to Donald's point, Tanya, let's look back for a minute. What does this mean for public education in black communities?
So are we talking about
high school, elementary
right.
schools?
So I want to make, I think we need to be very clear and distinct. This is a ruling on higher education, not on K through 12. and that there was other there. We've had an, the Louisville-Seattle cases, which is called the parents involved cases that I was also a part of. Interestingly enough, I'm from Louisville. Once again, I have a very unique history with issues of affirmative action and race in schools, and I was a part of I was a part of that consent decree that was existed within Jefferson County in the Louisville, Seattle cases. And this is this particular case here from the Supreme Court is about higher education. There's a higher standard because we are not guaranteed a free and quality education in higher education. We are guaranteed that within K through 12. And this is one of the things that I was dealing with when I was Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Education, is that we were making sure that it was understood at that point in time how it is that you could specifically use race in issues of K through 12. And that is distinct from how it is that you use it within the higher education context. So I don't want us to conflate those issues because they are two different issues. But what it does mean is that we have to be vigilant. I do agree with what Donald is saying, is that we've got to be about grassroots organizing. We've got to utilize our own power within our communities. For public education in the Black community, we have to recognize that we've got to be about ensuring that we are demanding the rights and the quality that our children deserve.
That's the point that I was making. Mm-hmm. That's the point that I was making. This isn't about the law. It is about what this decision says to educators in the Black community, policymakers on school boards in the Black community, what this says to parents, and in no small way, what this says if you want to trickle it down, or you've got, you know, that percentage of students who are in high school right now, who are listening to this, who are paying attention, who are reading the newspapers online and wondering, well, dang, I got to get my grades together. You know, I need to study. What does this mean for those lawmakers on school boards who say, well, instead of increasing the school budget by 3% this year, or next year, during that next fiscal year, maybe we need to take that up to 7% and focus on some other things.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, no, that is definitely what needs to happen, because, and this is what we have been arguing within the community for years, that this is that our educators need more because our students need more, and that we have not been providing the quality education that our Black and brown students need in order to achieve equality of opportunity in areas of higher education, that they're at a disadvantage.
But there's one other thing, though, and I think it's understated. And none of that, no matter how many people you have in these positions and what they think mean anything, and we don't revisit the question of our culture and our values in 2023 through 2050 as society changes. We can't, we have to embrace a dualistic strategy. It's a public strategy and a non-public strategy. In these debates, we're always talking about what everybody else, and accountability is critical on the public side, but equally private accountability is critical among ourselves. How we think, how we interact with each other, our value construct. And I think until we integrate the public and private side of that coin, we'll be talking about the public, and this is exactly what happened here. We put all of our eggs in the public basket with a court that is extremely conservative, with a series of elected officials across the country who are extremely conservative, and their decisions impact our lives because we've overly invested and depended on them for our fate when we have capacity within ourselves and our private side to do things to alter that and then to better influence and to strengthen our positions regarding the public mandates.
I guess, and somebody help me if I'm just taking this too far left, but in my, you know, non-attorney mind, the first thing that flashed in my head when I heard this was, if race is no longer a consideration, but we know that we cannot legislate prejudice, we cannot make people not see race through laws. But the thing that came to mind was, and maybe this is just too far left, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, if we don't get ourselves together, we could be right back to that situation where we're trying to integrate the University of Alabama, because they're not going to let, you know, they're not going to let us in. They have every reason now not to consider black people, because this was about discrimination against white and Asian people. And so that's going to make it just that much harder for black people who want to go to college, for them to go to college. And someone could, right or wrong, say, well, this is what the Supreme Court just did. You know, we don't have to consider race, but in their mind, they may very, the people in the admissions office, the people who are in control, may very well see this as a reason not to let black folks go to school.
I don't, I think, I actually don't think you are too far left. I don't think that, you know, as anyone who sees this decision, rightfully would be questioning what it is that we in the black community, black and brown community, indigenous community, Latinx community, what it is that we now have to do in order to ensure that we can achieve equality of opportunity in all aspects of our lives. And that it's not too far off the beaten path to think about, oh my goodness, so now there's going to be a concerted effort by many to try to continue to discriminate and not allow those that look like you and me to attain attain a quality education, or to get into schools of higher education, or to be in certain jobs. That's not too far left. But what is something that we do have control over is the power of our community. I think what we're not doing is fully exercising our power. And I think that what we need to do, and I think we in the Hip Hop Caucus, in, as that we say, we have to get up and organize and exercise not only our political power, but our economic power. And we need to put our, we need to be in those places where we can exercise the ability and utilize the power that we have in order to ensure that those who would want to keep us out of places, that we actually stop that. And we can do that. I think we are that, able to do that.
Yeah.
But that is something that we've got to organize in our community to do.
Tanya, you had the first word. Donald, I'll let you have the last word.
I think that it's deeper than that, and I think it's deeper than higher education. I go back to this pernicious thinking of Justice Taney and Dred Scott, that we've seen this notion of how white people in many parts of this country are viewing black people, and to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and the notion that they don't want to, many, and we see it in the majority opinion, they don't want to see that history and what it means. And there lies the danger, because that malignant cancer of racism or white supremacy becomes, it spreads. And I think we have to realize that our society, our nation is bifurcated and segregated into two different worlds, and it's increasingly segregated and divided. There lies the danger, and what comes out of that mind in the future towards our conditions and our people is really something we need to pay attention to.
We have work to do, no question about it. Donald Temple, Tanya Clayhouse, thank you both for being a part of this great discussion. It is not the last time that we will be talking about what is happening on the Supreme Court as it relates to our community. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, June 29th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.